As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by Alex Stewart.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, and Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hello, Joe.
Hello. There are two other guests who join us for bits of today's episode. The first is Liam Toomey, who comes along to talk about the recent situation, or the recent uncertainty, I should say, with Frank Lampard at Chelsea. Now, of course, they lost over the weekend to Manchester City. The Athletic released a story about Chelsea potentially talking about potential replacements. So we start with Liam. The middle of the episode, we then move on to do our sensible transfers bit, but from the perspective of the player, players including Julian Draxler. I've forgotten the rest.
Emi Buendia. Chelsea's Kepa is on there as well. Marcel Sabitzer, we talk about.
Marcel Sabitzer.
Then you go off on that weird little tangent about professional wrestling.
And then at the end of the episode, we talk to the wonderful Joey Durso, who releases an interesting piece, probably a bit of a pace change, come to think of it. I recorded it yesterday, so it probably won't fit in with the lightheartedness of the rest of the episode. But a very interesting discussion on how certain clubs approach the culture wars within football on the internet, i.e. When Premier League clubs display sort of rainbow colours or rainbow laces or whatever on their English-speaking social media and don't do it on other social media that is directed at other regions of the world. An interesting 10 minutes there and a discussion starter. So thanks to everyone for participating in today's episode. And of course, do you know where you can read great football stories, Alex?
Yes, I do.
And do you know how much it costs you to do so at the moment, Seb?
No, I do not.
It's £1 per week.
That's a good deal. That is good.
And do you know what makes it sound like a good deal, even more good deal? When you say, hey, afterwards. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you'll find that a £1 per week offer is available to you to enjoy all of the luxuries and exclusivity of being a member of the Athletic family. It sounds like I read that off something, doesn't it? That was really good. But do that, please. Theathletic.com/TIFO. And for now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of at least four different people. So Liam, at full time at the Manchester City-Chelsea game, obviously Manchester City won 3-1, you and Simon released a piece on The Athletic that suggested that Chelsea were talking about and thinking about potential replacements for Frank Lampard. And now, obviously, this isn't just in reaction to a 3-1 loss against Manchester City, however, you know, well Manchester City played in that game. But you did release it at full time. So can you talk us through the timing a little bit? Because I know there were a lot of people who read it who were interested in that aspect of it.
Yeah, safe to say there was a mixed reaction to the timing of our story, and some people found it a little bit distasteful. I don't think there's a good time to run a story like that, is the first thing to say. But the main reason why we released it when we did is because we'd been gathering information and hearing things for a number of days ahead of the game that suggested that Lampard's position was under serious threat. So obviously, even though the piece was released pretty much on the full-time whistle, it was not based on the Manchester City result. The thinking behind waiting until the end of that game was because if that game had panned out differently, if Chelsea's performance had been much more positive, there could have been the potential for the situation to materially change. You know, a win over Pep Guardiola at Stamford Bridge could have had a galvanising effect on the situation and maybe reassured people at the top of the club about the direction in which things were going. So we had to wait and see how the game played out to see if anything would materially change. And we were talking to the sources that contributed to the story, even during the game, to see how the situation was developing. And it quickly became clear, given the nature of Chelsea's performance and the fact that they weren't even competitive for large portions of the game, as excellent as Manchester City were, that what we were seeing was actually a continuation of the last month's form, really, that has raised serious questions about Lampard's suitability for this job long term in the eyes of the people above him. And so we ran the story, and it's never an easy decision to run a story as big as that, and we certainly didn't do it lightly, but we're very confident in the information that underpins it.
Liam, is this a situation which is all about performance and results, or are there other components to it?
So the first thing and the last thing is always results when it comes to a manager. And the fact that Chelsea's performances over the last month have not offered any cause for optimism beyond the results. You know, there aren't really any green shoots of improvement. And even the one game that they've won in the last seven against West Ham was nowhere near as convincing a performance as the scoreline suggested it was. So that's a huge, huge part of this, but it's not the only factor at play. The ongoing struggles of Timo Werner and Kai Havertz are a big issue. These were Chelsea's two headline signings. And in the case of Kai Havertz, someone that the club have been monitoring for a long time, have a huge amount invested in from the owner down. Everyone wants to see him succeed and be a key part of Chelsea's future. The fact that they've kind of been shifted around positionally and not found their rhythm in Lampard's system, I think, has hurt Lampard. And the other element of this is that, you know, tensions have been growing in the dressing room as well, within this squad, between certain members of this squad and Lampard, particularly some of the players that haven't been playing and perhaps don't feel like they've been given a fair chance by the manager. And this often happens at clubs. You know, part of a manager's job is to disappoint players that aren't quite as key to his plans. And it happens at Chelsea a lot, and these things become amplified when results are not going well on the pitch. The fact that Chelsea have a bigger squad than normal, I think, has made things worse, and the fact that they've got some more established players on the fringes now has made things more complicated. But that's all part of this equation, and it's left Lampard fighting to convince the people above him, really, fighting an uphill battle, it now seems, to convince the people above him that he is the man to oversee what was previously being described as a long-term project.
Yeah, I mean, that's my next question, really. I mean, what is the timeline here? Because it does feel as if this has kind of gone beyond a point of no return. What does Lampard have to do to convince those above him?
Well, the timeline is always the hardest thing to talk about, because when you're talking about Chelsea making a managerial change, it is essentially one man's decision. And he might not even necessarily know yet. The point of the story was simply to say that these conversations have started, and they're not abstract conversations. They're not saying we like this guy in Germany, or they're saying basically who could do better than Lampard with this group of players. And we know from the history of Chelsea that once those conversations start, we know how they finish. We've seen this movie before. So it is difficult to see what Lampard can do. I mean, the first thing is obviously win a few games, and Chelsea have a slightly more favourable run of fixtures coming up now after this City game. The performances will be every bit as important as the results. Chelsea need to look a lot more convincing in terms of the structure of this team, the cohesion of this team, the intensity, which has dropped off a cliff since they beat Leeds at the beginning of December. Those are all things that would help Lampard, but it's hard for me to see how he could completely convince the people above him now that these doubts have reached a certain stage, just because we've seen this. We've seen this in the Abramovich era. Once managers start facing these kinds of questions, it's very, very difficult for them to answer them in a way that gives them long-term job security.
Is there a particular attribute he is presumed not to have, or one that if he were to be replaced, the club would look to go after? I mean, you mentioned sort of the tactical identity and cohesion. Is there anything more to it than that? Because it sort of feels like, I mean, obviously results need to improve, but that's kind of a managerial imperative in the modern era. Is there something that he's lacking?
Well, I think one of the things that he's lacking that isn't possible to address at this point in time is a managerial track record. Everybody knew when Lampard got this job that he wouldn't have got it in normal circumstances. And I think he would be the first to admit that. He got it because he was Frank Lampard. He was arguably Chelsea's greatest ever player, and Chelsea were at a unique point in terms of the transfer ban and not really being the most attractive option to proven top coaches. But the fact that he doesn't have that track record of success at the top level in the dugout means that when you go through spells like this, it becomes harder for the people above you to believe that you have the capability to turn it round, just because they haven't seen you do it before in a way that many other more established coaches might be able to credibly argue. So that, I think, is one of the most significant things that Lampard lacks, and it's not something he can address. You know, this is the nature of the bargain that he and Chelsea both made when they signed up to this, was that they knew he was a rookie coach who would be learning on the job. And when moments like this come and that faith is tested, there isn't really a lot to fall back on to give Chelsea reassurance that he can get things moving in the right direction again.
Okay, so presumably somewhere at Stamford Bridge there's a list of potential replacements. What kind of names are on there?
Well, we can't talk about everything we know yet, which is why I know some people were frustrated that there wasn't more detail in the story that Simon and I published. We just had to point out that this process has begun, really. This story is beginning, and there will be a lot more time to talk about managers who are in the frame to succeed Lampard as and when that happens. The one thing I can say is that, you know, they don't have someone immediately lined up, because if they did, I think Lampard would probably already be gone. That's the way Chelsea operate. They are having conversations to assess their options. We know, of course, that Mauricio Pochettino is not one of those options anymore. He was someone that Chelsea liked for a long time, and they weren't the only top European club who very much liked Pochettino. But the timing on that has not worked. He's taken the PSG job and taken himself out of the market. But Chelsea will always back themselves in these situations if they feel like they need to get rid of Lampard sooner rather than later, i.e. before the end of the season, then they will back themselves to find someone who can come in either temporarily or who can be appointed immediately as the long-term manager who can do a better job of maximising this group of players. That's just the way Chelsea have always thought.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose that were they able to wait until the end of the season, that would be better for their long-term chances of getting it. Sorry, their chances of getting a long-term, you know, good long-term manager. But maybe, as you say, there's always temporary options. Anyway, Liam, thanks so much for coming to talk to us this morning. It must have been a busy weekend for you, so we appreciate it. And of course, if you want to hear more about the story now and you're fed up of us, you can go and listen to Liam and co on Straight Out of Cobham, the Chelsea-specific athletic podcast as well, which is a fantastic listen. So that's out now. Do go and enjoy it. And Liam, we'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Okay, we've done the bit on Chelsea. Let's now do the bit on sensible transfers. But amusingly, let's stay with Chelsea because Jax Warren asked us to talk about Kepa. So, Seb, let's begin with you. Pitch time elsewhere presumably is on the mind, given that Edouard Mendy has taken over the number one position at Chelsea. But, of course, Kepa was extremely expensive when he arrived, so presumably that prices him out of some clubs. What do you think about the situation?
Well, the difficulty, Joe, is probably also his wage, because obviously he came in for that big transfer fee, but also you'd imagine he's paid commensurate with his ability at the time and his standing in the game, which is no longer what it was. I think the difficulty with him is you could make a case for him wanting to go elsewhere, but where really would he go? Because his reputation has been damaged. We know this. His confidence is probably pretty low. So anybody taking a chance on him, even on loan, would be banking on him recovering, which I don't know, with goalkeeper, it always feels as if a goalkeeper is never just like one or two games away from returning to form or full confidence. He always needs like a couple of months. So that doesn't really suit the nature of a loan deal, does it?
Not really. And also, I was thinking as you're talking, for a goalkeeper, it's almost the worst position to play to get into this situation, because now, as you say, he's probably overpriced for what clubs would be willing to pay for him. As you describe, a loan deal for a goalkeeper is a fairly difficult one, particularly given that, you know, loan deals are often done by clubs who, you know, don't have the money to pay. And I know there are certain situations where they happen between bigger clubs, but looking around Europe at the moment and Europe's bigger clubs, who needs a goalkeeper that much?
Amongst the top clubs, no one, really. If you go around, I mean, you could probably make a case at Borussia Dortmund, possibly. But then these are all guesses based on the player that Kepa was, not the player that he is now, because the player that he is now just doesn't belong at a top tier club because he's a liability. You need to, ideally, he needs a landing spot in mid table, somewhere where the expectations are lower, where he can rebuild and where he can then begin his climb back to where he was. But then again, what kind of mid level club, especially now, has that kind of finance behind it?
Yeah, in the time of coronavirus. Alex, how would you deal with this?
If I were Kepa, I would probably wait it out. I'm maybe less hard on Mendy than Seb is, but at the same time, he doesn't strike me as the sort of player that you hang everything on. And as Seb correctly pointed out, you know, when Kepa was signed, he was signed for that sort of money because, you know, he was playing really, really well. I think Dortmund are a club that oddly haven't really addressed their goalkeeping situation for quite a while. Berkey is good, but he's not great. The other two that sort of spring to mind potentially, Roma are still using Antonio Morante quite a lot, and he's 37 and isn't amazing. And Roma do have spare cash and have taken goalkeepers on loan before. And Monaco as well, possibly. You know, again, there are financial considerations with Ligue 1, but Monaco are either playing Benjamin Lecomte or Vito Minoni, the ex-Sunderland goalkeeper.
Vito Minoni.
Yeah, right. So neither of them are amazing. Lecomte is 29. Minoni used to play for Sunderland. So, you know, if there's potentially spare cash around there to pay some of the wages, Monaco are the sort of club, I think, where, you know, you might be able to get your form back. But I think Seb's point there is really important, that goalkeepers, you know, part of what's happened with Kepa is this exposure to suddenly going to a really big club with a huge wage bill and a huge transfer tag. And that has clearly not worked out. The mental consideration there is enormous, and somewhere that he can rediscover his form and, you know, kind of nurse himself back to some degree of competence. I mean, potentially even return to Athletic. And, you know, Unai Simon is a decent goalkeeper, but he's not exceptional. And so that's, you know, that's where he came from. That's where he developed, and presumably as well, he'll have a relationship with the goalkeeping coaching staff there, which I think is really important. But his options are limited. I would say, you know, with the backdrop to the Chelsea situation, probably sitting it out and working hard in training is the sensible approach for him. But it's very, very hard to say. He's a particularly difficult case.
He needs to change his technique, to be honest. Like, when he's, if you watch him, his first step is always backwards. If you look at the kind of goals he concedes from set pieces or crosses, it's amazing, like, how reticent he is around the ball. So that's a confidence thing, though, right?
That's not a technique thing.
Well, I don't know, Joe. Maybe it is. It's just that it's something that's been in his game since he arrived in England, since very early on. If you look at, I always think of a goal he conceded at Wembley to Dele Alli, when Alli kind of, he won a header on the penalty spot and, you know, headed it kind of through Kepa. And I felt that described the flaw in his technique quite well, because all of his weight goes backwards. It'd be interesting to hear someone like David Priest talk about this, because it just seems it seems to be the opposite of what we're told a strong Premier League goalkeeper should be and how they should behave in that situation. Strange.
Well, David Priest was talking about Ilan Meslier on Twitter the other day. And one of the points he made is that Meslier's head quite often goes backwards. And obviously, when your head moves in a particular direction, a lot of the weight of your body follows that. And what he was saying is that is the sort of flaw that can be coached out of a player, that, you know, in terms of getting the head forwards, there are certain exercises that one can do to adjust that position, get the player diving forwards more or staying, you know, kind of lateral. And I think potentially with Kepa, you know, that there's a confidence issue, but the technical flaws are something that can be addressed with a good coaching team. And that's why potentially, say, a move back to Athletic on loan, where he can work with the coaching team that brought him to the level that he was at, would be good, because it may be that the change in goalkeeping coaching that he received when he went to Chelsea not necessarily introduce some of these flaws into his technique, but you know, change the way he was being asked to move, something like that, and that may be a contributory factor.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I was also going to say, I was looking at his page on Transfermarkt, which, as is my wont, I like to do that. And I don't know if you can guess, if I give you some info, obviously his transfer was for £72 million 2 years ago. At that point, Transfermarkt valued him at £54 million. Could either of you guess what his current estimated value is, according to Transfermarkt?
About half that.
About 20.
Less, 13.5. Mm. Which is quite a significant drop-off, isn't it? So maybe that makes him affordable. I don't know. I mean, you know, say the transfer fee at the time of the valuation was still £20 million over the top. That probably has something to do with the fact it was a big English club. But he's also only 26, and he's got a long career ahead of him.
That's what I was going to say. He has a lot of career ahead, which means that you can absorb some of this. You can give him a season or two to recover. I mean, he wouldn't necessarily be the very worst investment. He's just out of reach for a lot of clubs.
Poor guy. That's what I think. It sucks, doesn't it?
Sure does.
Well, I was a goalkeeper at school, so sympathise with goalkeepers because we're all great people. We're all great people. Julian Draxler, speaking of great people, great players, at PSG. This was asked for by Lewis Chappell. Alex, let's start with you. We were chatting a bit about Julian Draxler before the podcast recording. Talk to me about Julian Draxler.
He's a bit of an odd player. He came through the youth system at Schalke, which is, renowned for producing young players. And I'm sure we're possibly going to come and talk about Schalke a little bit later on. He then had one really good season at Wolfsburg, one not so great season, and then obviously moved to Paris Saint-Germain, where he's basically not done an awful lot. But he has actually been consistently reasonable when he's been called on. He's a surprisingly versatile player, so he can play as a left inside forward, which is what he does largely for the German national team when he still occasionally plays for them, but he can play as a 10. When he's come on this season for Paris Saint-Germain, he's often come on as the right-sided midfielder in a 3. He's a really nice kind of linking player. He's able to play good little passes forwards, receive the ball, spray it around. Reminds me a little bit of James Rodriguez playing that position at Bayern Munich a season or two ago, where he was, he's a creative player, but he was playing in a deeper role where his job was to kind of keep everything going. Now, that is with the caveat that at PSG this season, he's mostly been used off the bench. Popped up with an important goal against Metz when they were 0-0 until the absolute death and PSG were down to 9 players. So he still very much has something. It's just he's not getting game time because PSG has so many other good players in creative positions. I think any Premier League side that is not an established top 6 team would be good. I would particularly look, and I say this with the caveat that I would also include Arsenal in that, because I think as a short-term signing, he could be beneficial for Arsenal. Potentially someone like Newcastle, Fulham, I think would be interesting, Crystal Palace. Somebody who needs a versatile, creative player who's good at keeping the ball, good at doing sensible things with it. And he's also 6'1" and a decent presser of the ball. So he would physically, I think, adjust fairly well to the Premier League.
I would love to see Julian Draxler at Newcastle. I think that would be hilarious and exciting. And actually, he'd fit in with a squad of pretty decent attacking talent now. I guess Steve Bruce would probably still play 5 at the back, though, wouldn't he, Seb?
Yeah, and also all of that, nice attacking talent would just be watching Newcastle defend. So it's, sure. I don't know, sure. Like it'd be quite a lonely time for Julian Draxler at Newcastle, I think.
What is sensible for Newcastle isn't necessarily what's going to happen, but he would add something.
Exactly that.
He absolutely would. Let me put it this way to you, Seb. He was very exciting when he was at Schalke. People were talking about him all the time, as evidenced by his move to, Superclub PSG. So to hear Alex saying that, he would be a good fit at a Premier League team, including Arsenal, that wasn't in the top 6, it seems like a fall to me. Am I just misreading that? Am I looking through the media narrative?
No, I think you're right, Joe. Also, that Schalke team was great. There were, Lewis Holtby was in there, Klaas Jan Huntelaar was there, Jefferson Farfan. That was a really good side. I think the problem for Julian Draxler is that he is certainly good enough to play for PSG. And actually, in his second and third season, I think he was pretty heavily involved, maybe 25 plus appearances in the league. The problem is,
what's he like as a player, by the way?
Fun, yeah. Sweet ball striker, technically good. It's just that it's the profile, it's not the ability. It's the sense that he's, now forgive me, PSG fans, but he's just not famous enough to play for that side, because there's a certain expectation, I think, of profile. It also doesn't help if you are if you prefer to play from the left hand side, cutting in that team, because obviously that's Neymar's favorite position, really. And Mbappe takes up a little bit of space in that area as well. So it's career mismanagement. And nothing characterizes that more than us sitting here going, maybe you should go on loan to Fulham. You know, it's really quite damning.
And so I mean, they just steal for someone then, like, because you often find players who get into this position, you know, that, as you say, they make the wrong move as a possibility for what's happened here. They devalue themselves as a result of it. They're still expensive because they're coming from a big club, but they're looking for game time and they're willing to take opportunities and make some sacrifices. And then, you know, that I can think of so many players who've been a major success entering the Premier League at a kind of, you know, mid to or top table side, top half of the table side team, I'm saying. And yeah, but been a huge success upon arrival. That one quite excites me, that idea.
I would, in sensible transfers world, which is not quite the same as the actual transfer market, I would like to see Drax and James Rodriguez play behind Dominic Calvert-Lewin at Everton. I think that'd be really interesting.
Hello. Yeah, right? Although poor Everton... Old Richarlison.
Well, yeah, that's a fair point, actually. You probably have to build him into a three.
I think with Draxler, one of the things that encourages me about him is that he's played only just over 1,000 minutes in the last two seasons. Yeah. But in the league, he scored 2 goals and contributed 5 assists, which in terms of his, you know, per 90s for both of those, and that none of those goals are penalties, means that he's, you know, 0.5 last season, 0.6 this season. So he's contributing something for every 180 minutes he plays. And that for somebody who is not getting into a team, not necessarily because of ability, but because of the, you know, the cavalcade of really good attacking players that are ahead of him, speaks to somebody who is professional, who's able to maintain their standards, who's able to influence games when he does play. And there is that flexibility. Like I said, you know, he's been playing as a central midfielder recently and getting forwards quite a lot. So there's definitely still a player there. He's not like one of those guys who sort of drifted away from, you know, the early promise of youth and hasn't got the potential to still deliver on it, like a Max Meyer, for example. You know, it's there's a very good
Max
player
Meyer's
there.
A tragedy.
Yeah, maybe that's why Palace wouldn't take Draxler. But you know, if a good Premier League side took a gamble on him, I think they'd be handsomely rewarded.
Can I explore the Arsenal angle though, just momentarily? Because what is his favoured position? Would you say
his favoured position would be playing as a left inside forward?
So Aubameyang plays there for Arsenal, right?
But shouldn't. Well, I think that we would get into an Arsenal discussion. I think Arsenal should play Aubameyang through the centre because they need to have somebody that they can get the ball forwards to who's in an advanced position. And because Lacazette is having to drop off so much because of the lack of... I mean, the other thing with Draxler is that he could play as a 10 for Arsenal. He's good at getting forwards into the box. He's got that kind of passing that can unlock defences. As a 6'1" quick attacking midfielder, he can then get into the box himself and provide a threat. The goal against Metz was a header where he followed up on a blocked shot. So, you know, he would add something to a variety of different issues that Arsenal have. And I think stylistically he'd be a fit. Like, he's a very watchable player, like Seb said. You know, he's nice, he's elegant, he's upright on the ball. His passing range is good, you know, and as a sort of short term, we need to bring in somebody to add a bit of creativity and excitement where we don't currently have it. I think that would be a very plausible fit.
I like it. We need to move on though to Schalke. I mean, we're going to talk about a particular player, Ozan Kabak, who was asked for by listener Alk. But beforehand, Schalke, what the fuck? they haven't won a game. I didn't know this. I was reading the plan beforehand and it says Schalke are doomed, clearly. And I said, what are they? I thought Schalke were a good team. And then I looked, and so I'm assuming there are some people, probably not many as stupid as me, listening to this podcast who are unaware of this. Seb, can you take us through the situation?
I cannot. I know nothing about...
Oh, sorry, I've come to the wrong person. Alex, can you take us through the situation?
Yes, I can, because this morning before this podcast, I read Rafa Honigstein's piece on The Athletic about how and why Schalke have imploded. I mean, the short answer is that they're €200 million, or €200 million, in debt.
Yes.
That their team building has recently been, he has a killer line in the article, which is, those who stay do so because they're not good enough to leave. So
it's like where I came from, my town.
Yeah, that's okay, no comment. It's,
well, I won't say what town it was.
Like we've said, you know, Schalke have this reputation for producing good and exciting young players, and they go and they are replaced by, you know, sort of journeymen who aren't necessarily fitting in somewhere else. There's a huge pressure at the club because they're in the Ruhr Valley in Germany, which is kind of like the heart of German football. They have this massive rivalry with Dortmund, who've obviously overshadowed them massively of late. And there's also considerable unrest behind the scenes. So the whole thing is a basket case, and they're rooted to the bottom of the Bundesliga at the moment. They had David Wagner in, who didn't work out, the ex-Huddersfield manager. They've now got Baum in there, who's a much more kind of softly spoken, congenial guy, but isn't really getting great performances from them. And anybody who's good at Schalke is a saleable asset, and that includes Kabak.
Okay, well, tell me a little bit about Kabak then. I don't know anything about him.
He's a Turkish centre-back. He's a very good passer of the ball. He likes to bring it forwards. He doesn't dribble often, but when he does, he tends to pick his moments wisely and quite successfully. He loves these long kind of sweeping passes that take it from the right centre-back slot across to the left winger. He's very capable with those. Reasonably good in the air. And, you know, he's physically, like, he's 6'1", I think. He's not massive. He's not a really, really strong player. But he's got that kind of elegant, ball-carrying centre-back thing that people seem enamoured of at the moment. He's not as good on the ball as Sionchu. He's not quite as tough as Demirel, the Juve centre-back who's doing really well, who's Turkish. He's sort of in the middle, but he's only 20 and he does have a very high ceiling.
Okay, fair enough. Seb, presuming you don't know much about the player?
No, I do like Demirel, though. He's one that's really interesting because I know we're ad-libbing him onto the list, but kind of out of favour at Juventus, and he is he's one of those players that maybe, given the circumstances, could be taken away short term just to ease a wage bill somewhere else. But you know, someone
stop
would get a
trying
very,
to
very
sneak exciting additional players onto our list, Sev. We've got a list to get through here.
Demirel,
how dare you?
Demirel would definitely not look out of place in the Premier League.
Look what you've done, Seb. Although look what you started a conversation
derailed
about a
the podcast.
He's gonna pick it up now, and he's gonna talk about it with class and elegance.
No, well, I don't know if that he was me or Seb, but all I'd say with Demirel is that he's got that kind of slight toughness that Italian or centre backs who thrive in Italy have. The fact that he's not being used all that much at Juve is a slight surprise. I mean, he's not like totally peripheral there, but he's still young and he does look like he's physically cut out for a good Premier League side. Kabak's more of that sort of elegant on the ball type of defender. You know, if you were, I don't know if he's sort of like quite yet at Manchester City level, but it's that sort of style of defender rather than somebody who's a bit more roughhouse.
Do you know what I know about Demirel?
Tell me.
He's not on the list. Emi Buendia from Norwich. Lots of people have asked about Buendia. I think mainly because he's been linked to Aston Villa and the series of Premier League clubs, and so he should be because he's great. And I don't know if either of you saw his goal the other day against a team I've forgotten about, but Uncle Damien texted me and said, he said, "Oh, mate, you've got to watch." He doesn't sound like this. "Mate, you've got to watch the Emi Buendia goal." Watched it.
Hey, that's not a bad Uncle Damien, actually.
I've made him much more colloquial than he actually is. Lovely chap. Uncle
Damien. He's a lovely chap, Uncle Damien.
He sent me a game. I'm going to do a question for you in a second. He sent us a game. Anyway, he texted me and said, "Watch this goal." I can't remember who they were playing. Anyway, lovely goal. A lofted ball all the way from the halfway line off to the side a little. And he takes it on the volley and pops it just to the left past the keeper. Delightful stuff. For a man, he's you know, scored, you've written it here for me, 6 goals and 6 assists this season. Thanks very much. I know he struggled a little bit in the Premier League in terms of those statistics, the goals and assists and the actual goal contributions, but I think that's more to do with Norwich in the league because he certainly created a lot. I know that he's a popular sort of comparison to some of the Europe's big players in terms of his creative output, Alex.
Yeah, massively so. And it is particularly among like analytics Twitter, if we can refer to something as gauche as that. The fact that he's not moved to a Premier League side is a persistent mystery.
It's because he's a committed canary, that's why.
Well,
it's because he loves the club, Alex.
I suspect it's probably more because the club loves him and would therefore ask the earth for him.
Yeah, probably.
And I think he's contracted for quite some time yet, possibly.
And he'll have a riverside apartment in Norwich. And
yeah,
you know,
Norwich
Daniel
is a
Farker
beautiful
seems like a
city,
fun guy. Lovely,
you know.
City.
Right.
A lot of, you know, safe walking. Go on.
And Norwich could get re-promoted. So, you know, there's every reason for Norwich to make him as unappealing
they
to suitors as possible.
Absolutely.
But I think this is just carrying your pro Norwich bias through a question, isn't it?
No.
It's just really weird subliminal propaganda just seeping
it's
out.
It's not even subliminal, Seb. It's absolutely direct.
It's subliminal. It's subliminal.
It's really subliminal.
Tourist board.
I should. No, they should just start sending me some money. Because tell you what, lovely place to go. Not at the moment though. Stay away. Don't want. You know. We just got to. Hey, stay at home. Carry on.
I mean, I have been to Norfolk on holiday, and it was quite nice.
A lot of pigs there.
A lot of what?
There's a lot of pigs in Norfolk. They do a lot of pig farming.
Right. I mean, I can't say that was...
Hang on. I got shouted at for bringing Demerel into the podcast, and now you've got to... Norfolk.
That was just my vibe
lots of
at the
pigs,
time.
Pigs per capita in Norfolk. The Norfolk Tourist Board. Safe walking in Norwich.
Seb, what do you think about Emi Buendia?
I find it strange. I actually feel as if he was damaged by what happened last season and the kind of the slightly false narrative around him and the kind of the lazy tag that he was whipped with. It felt that as if the sort of the combination of that and the likely very large transfer fee kind of prevented him from getting moved. Not probably not into the top four, but into sort of a top eight type side, I think.
So what's a good fit? Let's pick a club. Let's pick a Premier League club that's a good fit for him.
Honestly, Norwich. I like the idea of a player staying, getting re-promoted and coming back into the Premier League, because I think that if you wait 18 months and he gives a better account of himself in the Premier League with a team and a manager that he knows, the move he gets as a result of that is going to be better.
Well done, Seb. You can talk more. Do you want to say anything else about Demerel? You can now.
No. My Demerel enthusiasm has been snatched away.
Alex, have you got anything else you want to say about Buendia, or shall we very, very quickly do Marcel Sabitzer?
I agree with Seb.
Okay, then very, very quickly do Marcel Sabitzer.
Sabitzer is an interesting creative player. He's in the sort of the wide areas of the 4-2-2-2 that Leipzig use. He cuts inside. Good, hard-working player, creative, would fit at Southampton, although Stuart Armstrong is in that role currently and doing very, very well and has just signed a new contract.
Okay. Seb, anything to add?
It's character with him. He is he's a horrible little player to play against. Gifted, technically really good, but I think that the teams that are going to be interested in him are, they're going to go after the competitor. I saw him live, actually, in Leipzig, right at the beginning of the lockdown, just before it started. And he is just this sort of bundle of, not quite aggression, but yeah, he's just competition, he's niggly, and that all sort of complements a, you know, like real, like pronounced technical ability. I think he'd be a good fit at Tottenham, actually. The finances were probably a little bit prohibitive, but super player. And a perfect Jose Mourinho player as well, because of this attitude towards playing the game and the way he holds himself on the pitch.
That I think that's right. He's like when Shaqiri's at his best, that's
spiky,
sort of nuggety, unpleasant, but with all of the technical ability. If you get him motivated, then he's spiky. And I think that's why he would be a good fit in the Premier League, because he, you know, he's not going to be, as although he's creative, he's not going to be bossed around.
Right, well, we're going to be doing more sensible transfers in this form for the rest of, well, most of January. But for now, before we come back to say goodbye to you, there's 10 minutes with our good friend Joey Durso talking about a piece that he's written recently on the culture war in football.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, Joey, you wrote this piece, The Premier League's Internet Culture Wars. You use a few different examples in the piece. The main one, or at least the one that you begin with, is Liverpool making headlines around the world as they show a heartwarming exchange between Jordan Henderson and a gay fan. And you note that on many of Liverpool's social media outlets, on Twitter and on Facebook and stuff, certainly the English language versions, they have the rainbow colours, but on some of their social media accounts that are dedicated to other regions and are written in other languages, those colours are absent. Tell me a little bit more about this.
Yeah, so it certainly wasn't just Liverpool. I saw this with Tottenham, Man United, other big clubs. And what they did is, as you said, in the English account, they'd have, you know, very prominent rainbow messages for Rainbow Laces, which is the Premier League's anti-homophobia campaign. But then notably in other languages, they didn't. And there's a bit of an sort of awkward pattern to it that they tend, you know, they might have done it in French or Spanish, or, you know, because clubs have accounts for all sorts of different languages. But in the, particularly in the Middle East, Arabic language, there was sort of no mention of it, which I think is pretty easy to surmise. That's because, you know, attitudes towards gay rights there are not what they are in the UK. And I spoke to, you know, I approached all the clubs and they didn't respond, perhaps understandably, slightly embarrassed about it. But I spoke to a man called Wael Jabir, who runs social media accounts in Arabic in the Middle East. And he just says, you know, if you do these things in Arabic or Turkish towards the Middle East, there would like to be a massive backlash. You know, homosexuality is illegal in many Middle Eastern countries and people, you know, wouldn't be happy with it. And I think it's an interesting debate. Should Premier League clubs just do it anyway, or do they risk, you know, creating a homophobic cesspit on their own account by doing it? It's a really hard one. And I think, you know, and all clubs are dealing with this at the moment is they try and expand around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing that for me about it that my first instinct, and I'll talk openly now, is to assume that the clubs are being cynical and commercially minded, and of course they wouldn't want to do that because it would breed negative response, and obviously they want their fans to support them and be happy with them. How much do you think that plays into it? Because I know also you spoke to one or two people from the club side of things who had a slightly different perspective and explained why they thought doing it actually might be counterproductive. I wonder if you can walk us through that side of the thinking, because as I said, my first instinct is just to think, well, that's pretty shallow.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think people who are high up in football clubs tend to be the sort of exec level or the senior management level tend to be, you know, fairly liberal people on those sorts of topics such as gay rights and racism, and I think they are sincerely, to an extent, motivated by being against homophobia. But, you know, as soon as that clashes with other cultures, I think that can get really difficult. And there's still no out gay players in English football, and there's rife with abuse in you know, and there've been some good Athletic podcasts about that issue. So it's certainly not just something that happens in other countries. There are some other interesting issues as well. Like, for example, poppies. You know, as any British listener will know, but maybe not from other countries, is that the end of the wars is celebrated in this country, but not celebrated marked with the poppy, which is this flower that grew on the graves of the fallen soldiers. And, you know, in this country, that's a fairly sort of politically neutral event. You know, most people will get behind it. But in other countries, particularly the Middle East, where they remember the, you know, the Iraq War, for example, the British Army doesn't have a great reputation, and they don't put the poppies on the thing. It was maybe a more understandable difference in how social media is run in different countries. Another one is religious references, which might seem odd, but you know, I found a few tweets in Liverpool talking about Robbie Fowler as God, and in parts of the world that's just a no-no.
Yeah, that's true. The other one that was really interesting is the take a knee before the game, which was long associated with Black Lives Matter as a movement, and I think they've changed what they're calling it now, right?
Yeah, no room for racism is what they call it. I mean, this is a really interesting one because I joined lots of these Facebook groups and spoke to various people who run them, fans of various clubs, and pretty much all of them were behind the Rainbow Laces campaign or against homophobia in football. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean they act out in their daily life, but I didn't detect much sort of resentment towards that. Black Lives Matter, there really was quite a lot towards taking the knee. Quite a lot of fans said that you know, there's a huge issue in their groups, you know, sort of Southampton supporters group or whatever, it would come up again and again and again. And the arguments people used were, you know, why still do it? You know, haven't they done enough? Or associating Black Lives Matter with some of these more radical political organisations in the US and, you know, tearing down statues and things like that. I mean, there are lots of good, really, really good arguments against that. I think, you know, Ryan Conway from The Athletic wrote a great piece on that. But there definitely is a lot of resentment from some fans towards the Black Lives Matter and taking the knee. And at the extreme end, you saw that plane that flew over Burnley during that game, White Lives Matter Burnley. But there is a sort of lower level resentment as well, sort of why they're still doing it, you know, can't they move on sort of thing, which I think does go down quite deep. And it's not, you know, it's not all white supremacists. It's people who are sick of it. And, you know, there's, as I said, Ryan wrote some really good counter arguments to that. If you know someone who's saying that sort of stuff, but it's the culture war. It's football clubs are now at the centre of these culture wars, these political debates. And I think that really wasn't the case 10 or 20 years ago. They sort of just opt out and not talk about it as much.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think what's interesting about the Black Lives Matter example, or the taking the knee example, is a lot of the sort of criticism of it that I read. Relates to how it is a political stance, which I find to be an odd thing. I mean, at first glance, you know, the assumption being you're suggesting that the opposition to racism is political, which those people will generally go on to tell you, "Well, that's not what we're saying. We're saying that Black Lives Matter is officially a political party now in the States, and they have these policies and beliefs in their manifesto, and I don't want to be aligned with that, and that's a political." And to a certain extent, I understand that, but at the same time, I think you have to be being quite obtuse to not recognise the nuance in a political statement like taking a knee. I don't think it's because the Premier League players are expressing their political alignment with a political party in the States. That's clearly not what it's about. And I think, you know, people might express fears over that, perhaps spreading without people realizing it, and maybe they want to raise awareness of it or whatever. But that kind of argument always reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever seen this bit, but I can't remember what show it was, but Stuart Lee had a show where one of his bits was doing an impression of someone who said that they had the political, but he said you know, he has genuine concerns about closening political ties with Europe, but he does it in a funny voice, and that style of argument is, I think, the point, you know, being made by this bit is often something which covers up something else, which is just that you don't like it. And I basically don't have any tolerance for that. As it relates to the issue of exporting that view overseas, that it does become more complicated. Personally, not for me. And I think the issue that I have there...
Do you think the club should just sort of do it? Just put the regulators on the Arabic and write it out?
I'm glad I'm not in the position where I have to make that decision. I'm glad I'm in a position where I can say,
I'm really hard to say. Yeah.
But
I know what would happen. Maybe clubs should join together and do it, you know, just say, you know. I think if they all did it, it'd be less of a. It'd make it easier.
Maybe it would, and also I guess, you know, it's a kind of issue with with what was once a kind of national sport now being a kind of globalized league. I think, you know, the real crux of the issue, I think, to come back to the beginning for me, is that these are commercial entities. They have commercial interests. It would be counterintuitive, I'm sure, for what are now massive global brands to disenfranchise huge numbers of their supporters overseas who share different beliefs and some that we wouldn't be tolerant of here, at least where I am recording this podcast, maybe not where people are listening to it. But the problem for me is it reminds me a little bit of when, you know, Twitter marked Donald Trump's tweets. I think that's a good thing, but I don't think it's a good thing that Twitter has the power to do it. You know, it's a very complicated... nuance of the modern world. And I suppose the issue for me is that football clubs are even in this position, and that the heads, and I'm sure the people who are making these decisions are also the people who are making commercial decisions and not necessarily the heads of the supporters groups or the actual community behind the clubs. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it's also important to remember that this idea of clubs being pressured to take social stances, we're talking here about you know, maybe not posting the rainbow stuff in certain areas, but it sort of goes the other way as well. Like, I think there's a good example from America. The Milwaukee Bucks boycotted a game, a really important game, because of George Floyd, who was from very nearby. The black man was killed by the police around that time. And the players just said, you know, we're not playing. And the owners kind of fully backed them. And, you know, they were being pulled, you know, they were being pulled in a sort of liberal social direction by players and fans, and they knew that it would be very costly to them if they went against that. And I think, you know, the same is true with, you know, there's, we hear a lot about the opposition to Black Lives Matter, but, you know, it's been football players that are driving it. Lots of fans are very much, you know, in favour of it. And, yeah, I think there's a kind of, especially as, certainly in this country, politics is sort of split between, you know, older generations that are more conservative and younger ones that are more liberal. You know, you get a lot of young people who are, spend a lot of time on the internet, especially in a pandemic, and they're going to be, you know, haranguing their football clubs to be more, to take social liberal stances. I think it goes both ways.
It reminds me also of Nike. I think it was Nike doing the massive Colin Kaepernick advertising campaign shortly after that taking the knee thing began, which seems, you know, initially to be a, you know, you would have thought in the same way that some of these football clubs might not want to post the rainbow laces on their Arabic-speaking accounts, for example. It might seem like a naive commercial decision, but when inspected more closely, it seems like a very clever commercial decision based on, you know, the future of that company.
Yeah, it's trying to sell trainers to sort of young men, you know, lots of probably black men who, and the sort of old white women, well, whatever gender, who might disagree with that, probably not the kind of people they're trying to sell to.
There you go. Well, anyway, Joey Durso, the porn bot guy, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
You don't have to explain that. People think it's weirdo.
No, I won't. But if you want to know why, you should go to the YouTube channel and look for porn bots on Tifo, and you'll get to see Joey in person. Joey, thanks, man. And hopefully we'll chat to you again soon. By the way, people really should check out your writing, because you write fewer pieces than the other Athletic writers do, but you can really see the value in that when you do post something. It's I always read it on the
fewer pieces.
Maybe you should. Even fewer. But yeah, we'll definitely be back soon, and we'll chat about some of the other weird things you've been writing about.
Cheers, Joe.
Okay, that was Joey Durso. Hey, thanks, Joey. Much appreciated. Alex and Seb, very quickly, I wanted to say to you before we go, Uncle Damien bought us a gift, which only I will have because of the practicalities of us living in different places. But it's a football and sports trivia gift. Mm-hmm. Exciting? Let me whet your appetite.
Excellent.
Kazuki Honda asked Manchester United to sign him on Twitter. True or false? True or false? Come on, it's for Uncle Damien.
Oh no, I think that's true.
It is true. It is true. Cristiano Ronaldo's father was Scottish. True or false?
False.
And that's the end of it for now. But we'll do more.
Is that all that we're allowed to have?
That's all that you're allowed. I'll tell you what, you can do one more. Sports trivia. Question. What name is the professional wrestler Mark Calloway better known as? Is it A, The Rock, B, The Undertaker, or C, Triple H?
The Rock is... Jalen, what's The Rock's name?
Dwayne Johnson is The Rock.
Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah. So it's a double-headed.
I would say The Undertaker.
Here. You are right. And do you know what? There's a fantastic six-part documentary series about The Undertaker called something like The Undertaker. I don't know what it's called. But someone sent it to me and I watched it and it's really funny.
Six parts?
That man has had...
I don't understand wrestling.
Oh, he's had like 70 surgeries, or not that many, but something like 21 surgeries. Anyway, it was made by the WWE Network, so it's got it's a bit like The Last Dance, but it's just The Undertaker and lots of other wrestlers. But the friend who sent it to me watches wrestling and enjoys it, and said, you know, I'm always making fun of him, and he said, oh, you have to watch this. To be fair, you know, pretty good six-part documentary series.
Six parts?
Might have been four parts. I don't know.
Wow.
Can't remember. It all blurs into one, doesn't it, when you're watching a man have all of his hips replaced. But they built up to this kind of final. I'm sure people listening who watch WWE will be aware of this, but obviously, you know, they are not unaffected by the pandemic, as you can imagine. So they've had to change up how they're doing WWE. And I think they're, you know, creatively thinking about different ways that they can exhibit fights or wrestling matches or whatever they're called. And one of them, the very famous one, I think it was called the Boneyard or the Graveyard fight. It was supposed to be the Undertaker's final comeback fight against somebody I've never heard of. And tell you what, it is very funny. If you've got 5 minutes today.
Man, producer Ben is going to shout at you.
Just go and watch some of the, honestly, nothing but respect for the way that these people make it. They are clearly committed professionals, and you obviously have to love this to do it because it's hard work. I totally respect and appreciate it. It's just funny to watch because when you take the crowd away and you take the sort of association of the ring away and, you know, the... I don't know, all of the sort of trappings, and you put them in a boneyard and there's no one cheering and they're dressed up still and they're in the real world. It just seems, you know, it's a bit like if Gandalf just appeared on Upper Street. You know, it's just out of context, Gandalf looks ridiculous. In context, Gandalf looks like a badass. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it.
Anyway, we'll do more trivia in the next episodes. Thanks, Uncle Damien, who's had his pub closed due to the national lockdown. So best wishes from Tifo to him. Anyway, we'll be back on next Tuesday to do more of this and hopefully to chat about whatever's happened over the weekend. So, Alex, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Seb, thanks to you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Au revoir to the listeners. Goodbye.